This is Geek Gab with your hosts, Darnall and me, Daddy Warpig. We are back. Geek Gab for Monday, March 11th, 2024. And yesterday was Oscar night.
Was it?
It was. You know, I thought it was three glorious hours of, you know, Oscar whatever stuff, but I saw an Oscar live watch party, and it said it was 5.5 hours, so...
What?
I don't know if I spent time before and after to talk about it, but... I mean, I imagine they did, but still... I can't watch 5.5 hours, even if it's only 3 hours. I couldn't watch 3 hours today. So today's post on the Gab blog was about the Oscars. And it was basically every good clip from the Oscars that there were. So you didn't have to spend 3 hours watching it to get to the three good moments of the show. So I found the three good moments of the show and put them up for you on the blog so that you didn't have to, and that's geek-gab.com, so that you didn't have to go looking yourself.
Well, cool.
And they are
funny.
I'm going
to have to check that out.
I mean, they're good moments, but they're not 3 hours worth of good moments.
No. I did not used to watch the Oscars.
There were actually some winners who got in on sheer merit. Godzilla Minus One won for visual effects. Oppenheimer won for Best Picture, which I believe we talked about last week. Or at the very least, I've been talking about on my Twitter. Robert Downey Jr. won for... and I think Christopher Nolan might have... Christopher Nolan also won Best Director, and Robert Downey Jr. won Best Supporting Actor. So... It was... It was good to see some things win on sheer absolute merit rather than, you know, the new rules the Academy put into play. I just thought that was brilliant. Last year they announced new rules like you have to have a certain percentage of your crew and certain percentage of your cast meet certain percentages of diversity quotas.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In order to be eligible just for Best Picture. Well, Oppenheimer doesn't meet any of those quotas.
Won it anyway. So,
Oppenheimer comes out this year, and basically the Academy, who announced this big fanfare, they're striking blows for social justice. And Oppenheimer doesn't meet any, but they nominate it anyway, and they vote for it anyway, and it wins anyway because everybody knows it's going to. Like, the entire Academy, all 3,000 voters are going to vote for Oppenheimer, pretty much. And so the Academy has to kind of quietly ignore its big, huge announcement from last year and just kind of hope nobody notices that they walked right on past their own big, huge social adjustment announcements. Oh, well, that doesn't really count for this year. Just don't even mention it. Like, it doesn't exist. And then maybe next year they'll start enforcing it. And who knows? Maybe every time Christopher Nolan makes a movie from now on in, they're just going to have to...
That's pretty typical. It's one of those situations. What's the quote? You've made your law. Now let's see you enforce it.
Yeah. Also, know if you remember Zombie Emma Stone from Zombieland and Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man 2 and some other stuff. She won apparently another Oscar last night for Poor Things, which I didn't see. Apparently it's sort of a, it's sort of related really loosely to a Frankenstein story. Somebody brings her back from the dead or something. So it's supposed to be her second Oscar. And Robert Downey Jr.'s won one Oscar and Emma Stone has won two.
That sort of seems skewed.
I'm just wondering what's wrong with the world. What's wrong with you guys? But that's all the Oscar news I have. Go to geek-gab.com to see the three good moments. And they're all really good moments from the Oscars. Now, technically speaking, there may have been a few more, but I wasn't going to watch all 3 hours to kind of pick them out for you. I depended on other people to pick them out.
Smart move.
But I did pluck them from the Twitters and put them up for others to share. Apparently, and this is the most pathetic thing of all about the Oscars, Donald Trump was watching the Oscars, and the guy who used to do the main show, who has his own nighttime talk show, whose name I can't remember.
Jimmy Kimmel.
Jim Kimmel, that's him. Well, he was hosting the Oscars this year. Go figure. Donald Trump on Truth Social put out a post criticizing Jimmy Kimmel's hosting. So Jimmy Kimmel clapped back live on the Oscars.
Oh, that's I wouldn't bet. I wouldn't do that.
Is that not pathetic?
That's really kind of sad.
That is literally the biggest gig of his career. The most prominent thing he's ever done. The Oscars. The biggest night, supposedly, for movie people ever. And he breaks script to go into this spontaneous dig at President Trump because he made a post on Truth Social. I'm just like, I mean, I know he didn't host the Oscars. I know he only hosted the Golden Globes. But that British comedian, whose name I can't remember.
Ricky Gervais.
Ricky Gervais. I can't imagine him clapping back against Joe Biden if Joe Biden insulted his. Or maybe he could, but he would have made it funny. He would have made it seem like classy, like you expected it. He wouldn't have made it seem this petty, mean, small, pathetic thing. Also, good news from the Oscars. Will Smith is banned. He's banned for another, last night, the next 9 years from the Oscars.
So he doesn't slap anybody else?
Yeah, so Jimmy Kimmel did not actually get slapped last night by Will Smith.
That's a shame.
Now, I admit, I didn't double check that story. I didn't verify that, but I also didn't see any news about it, so I just assumed that everything was okay. I just assumed that Will Smith didn't break into the Oscars to go slap Jimmy Kimmel around. I may have been wrong about that. That may have been a big assumption on my part. I may be giving Will Smith too much credit there, but there were no news stories that I saw about Will Smith slapping Jimmy Kimmel, so I just assumed that it didn't happen. So we've got 9 more years, we hope, of peace at the Oscars before we have to worry about Will Smith smacking any of the hosts around again.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Maybe by then he'll have retired. He'll just get the Lifetime Achievement Award.
So, anyways, that's the Oscars news from last night. I'm trying to think if there's any... All the other news I have really on the top of my head. We did a post this week about Fallout. The Fallout TV series, the Fallout streaming series on Amazon is coming out in April. So, the last trailer was awful. It was a terrible trailer. This trailer was amazing, primarily because they put Walton Goggins right up front and focused on him pretty much the whole... He was like the spine the trailer was built around. Other people may have had a bunch more time than him, but he was the absolute beginning and ending of the trailer, so it made it into a great trailer. I'm still predicting it's going to be an awful show. And I did a post about that to explain why. So you can go again, geek-gab.com, to get my analysis on that. These are things that we save time by not talking about on the show because we just can't talk about everything on the show. But they're long, you know, I'm doing longer posts now. So not just tiny little things. They're actually, you know, longer analysis we might have done on the show, but we don't have enough time to cram in anymore. Argyle, which I did not see and have not reviewed, looks just awful.
Yeah. I won't be seeing that one.
But it's available for rent right now for like $19.
Wow.
If you want to rent it on streaming, it's 19 whole dollars. Which totally I haven't kept it up with inflation. Maybe that's a reasonable amount. No, I'm kidding. I have kept on inflation on like rentals. Rentals are like $3.99 on streaming, maybe $5.99 for really good movies. They are not $19.99. But if you wanted, if you felt the need, the uncontrollable urge to own Argyle, you could own it for only $4 more.
That is a deal, man.
Is that a deal or what? That's DRM protected video you can download to your hard drive. Gaming news. Sweet Baby Inc. I don't think we talked about this before.
No, I've actually been away from all news for a couple of weeks now, and it's very nice. So tell me about this.
Did you swear it off for Lent?
I did. Well, technically I swore off social media, which was the only place I was getting news. So there you go.
Oh, so it was like 2-for-1.
Yeah. Yep. My mind is at peace. If it weren't for the Bro SR, I don't think I'd ever go back to Twitter, but we'll see.
So Sweet Baby Inc. is a consultancy company. It is their job to consult with video game companies on how to make their stories and their characters more diverse. And they have been connected with many of the most famous bombs and studio shutdowns of the last several years. For instance, Volition Studios shut down after they tried to reboot Saints Row. That was a Sweet Baby Inc. joint. The new game from Bethesda Studios, their new IP, it's not Starscape, but it's Star something. Star Burst, Star Shine, Star Port, Star something. I can't remember. It's 6 months in and nobody can remember. It was receiving a lot of, you know, consultation with Sweet Baby Inc., which is why their Russian character is, shall we say, a more diverse Russian, which was really disconcerting. And why all the people in the crowd are just absolutely appallingly ugly.
That's Bethesda for you.
But no, it's not Bethesda. It's Sweet Baby Inc., because Bethesda's never done that. This is not Bethesda graphics ugly. This is... because
no, that's Bethesda's got a reputation for ugly, ugly characters.
Right, just because of their graphics, not because they're trying to make their characters ugly. This is not Bethesda.
No, that's right. It's not from deliberate action. It's sheer incompetence.
This is deliberately making people doughy and fat and misshapen and whatever. It is hideous.
That's strange.
You've obviously never played the game or seen videos of the game, so you don't know what I'm talking about.
I do not.
It is because of Sweet Baby Inc. Forspoken, another infamous game.
Oh, yeah, infamously also, terrible, yeah.
Sweet Baby Inc. was connected with that.
Mm-hmm.
A game that won Game of the Year last year and then completely disappeared from the zeitgeist because it was actually awful, despite winning Game of the Year. Sweet Baby Inc. consulted on it. And I'm talking about Alan Wake 2. Sorry, I remembered I skipped the name there. The recent Suicide Squad pee on the bodies of the Justice League, which I know we've talked about on the show before.
Yep.
Guess who consulted on the story?
I can guess. That's incredible.
The only member of the Justice League who received any respect and who didn't get literally or figuratively peed on is Wonder Woman.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's a woman and you can't diss the woman. Sweet Baby Inc. So this company has its tendrils throughout gaming. And there are about a dozen other companies just like this. The video game industry all over, all video game companies hire small grifter companies like this to come in and be, and I did not make this term up, inclusivity readers. To make sure their games are inclusive. So they first started becoming a thing about 2.5 months ago. People first started noticing them. And then about 2.5 weeks ago, someone created a Steam group called Sweet Baby Inc. Detector, I think.
Okay.
Where they basically took all the games that were on Sweet Baby Inc.'s own website that they had bragged about consulting on and made a recommendation list for, so everybody, or a review list for, so everybody could see on Steam which games they had consulted on and make their own decision about whether or not to buy them. Now, the people at Sweet Baby Inc. went nuts over this. The funny thing is, they interpreted this as an attack against Sweet Baby Inc., like the people were trying to drive customers away from Sweet Baby Inc. games. But I assure you, this was too little, too late, because customers were running away from Sweet Baby Inc. games already.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of the games I have listed were, with maybe one exception, massive failures. They had already failed. People already weren't buying them before they knew they were Sweet Baby Inc. games. But now people are looking at upcoming games and seeing if they're Sweet Baby Inc. games and thinking to themselves, hey, maybe I shouldn't buy these games. Oh, the new Fable game with the infamously repulsive main character. That's a Sweet Baby Inc. joint.
Mm-hmm.
So what a Sweet Baby Inc. employee tried to do was they tried to summon up a crowd of brigaders to go to Steam and report this group to try and get Steam to ban the group and ban the user to get him kicked off Steam so he would lose access to his literally hundreds of Steam games. He's had the account for like 13 years.
Wow.
Or 12 years. Because he's a white supremacist who was trying to stop, this is their real accusation, trying to stomp down on inclusivity and diversity and whatnot, equity in video games. By the way, the founder of this group is a black man from Brazil.
Infamous Brazilian white supremacists, yes.
Yes. That large cadre of black Brazilian white supremacists that we all know of. So the membership of this Steam group went from about 15,000 at that point to where it's about 250,000 now.
250,000.
250,000.
That's pretty good.
A quarter of a million people have joined this Steam group. So here's where things get really interesting.
Okay.
Slash V, the video game discussion board, not on Reddit, which is where you would expect this to happen, but on 4chan, started banning all discussion of Sweet Baby Inc. and moving all those threads to slash poll, the politically incorrect discussion board.
I've heard something like this before.
And a bunch of games journalists at different sites, starting with Kotaku, published articles claiming that evil racist gamers were harassing the noble and decent diverse minority gaming consultant people at Sweet Baby Inc. And that they were carrying out a vast harassment campaign.
Come on.
Against Sweet Baby Inc.
You have to be making this up.
I am so not making this up.
You have to be making this up. Isn't this the 10th anniversary?
Yes.
This is the 10-year anniversary. It never dies. They never learn.
And that was my comment. I'm like, couldn't they wait until August? That was my comment on Twitter. So the writer for Kotaku goes to quote unquote infiltrate the Steam group by joining the Steam group under her name and her photo. She's infiltrating it.
Infiltrating it. Mm-hmm.
As a spy would. A cunning spy.
Very cunning.
And the question she asks is, and you, this is not a lie, I swear I am telling the truth, is, why aren't all of you guys under your own names and faces? So now a bunch of YouTubers are making videos about Sweet Baby Inc. and about the journalists who are attacking gamers. They're making YouTube videos. And a whole bunch of people who hadn't heard anything about it are now hearing about it.
Wow.
And people are using this new hashtag in their tweet.
What's the hashtag, Daddy Warpig?
The hashtag, and I am not making this up, the hashtag is Gamergate 2. And it is 2024.
What is happening?
It's 10 years later.
First of all, I can't believe it's been 10 years.
It's 10 years later from the first Gamergate. I'm watching this play out in real time. Because I was keeping track of this all, not like deliberately. I wasn't like glummed in on it, but I'm plugged into all the news sources where these sorts of things play out. And I was watching all this happening in real time. And I'm like, I was feeling this dawning sense of dread as each little piece clicked into place. And I was getting this sense of deja vu. And I'm like, no, this can't be happening again.
I'm speechless. So,
I'm just reporting the news. That's all I'm doing. So that's
well. This the news. this isn't what I thought we were going to talk about today. Holy cow! Blast from the past.
That's the news for today. That's it. I'm done with news. That's everything up until now.
Wow. Keep me posted, I guess. This news is way too amusing not to know. I'll have to stay tuned to the blog for more details.
There is one tiny little bit of news. Deadlift, which is one of the Kotaku family of sites under Gawker. So it was Deadlift and Jalopy and Gizmodo and Kotaku and stuff. Deadlift was sold off today. The news just broke literally like a few hours ago. Was sold off today to some European venture capitalists. And the very first thing they did is fire everybody. And locked them out of the site.
Oh, beautiful. I'm shocked that anything related with Kotaku is still in business. I thought they'd gone under with everyone else.
So there are still a few of those sites left running, including Kotaku, but I don't know. I'm just looking at this Deadlift thing and I'm thinking, ask not for whom the bell tolls, Kotaku. It tolls for thee. So, do you want to start off talking about our actual subject today?
I guess, yeah. Well, what can I say? Brand new movie came out, and because it's March, it might be a movie that people want to see. We got a sequel to Dune. You remember that came out a few years ago?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Yeah, so we talked about it. We liked it, so had to go see it. See Dune Part 2. I've got another funny story. Did you notice the image I used for today's episode?
I absolutely did.
Okay. Dune Part 2, it picks up right where the last one left off. You know, the young Paul Atreides and his mom are fugitives on the desert planet after, you know, his family was wiped out and the Harkonnens took over and everything. Which brings me to my first point.
Literally right where it left off.
Literally right where it left off.
The guy he killed, they've wrapped up his body and they're walking back to the home base. It is like minutes after, like 20, 30 minutes after the last movie ended.
Yep. Which sort of brings me to my first observation is, my wife says, we should have watched Part 1 because I don't remember anything. This is not a movie you see without knowing anything.
Yeah.
That is one of the downsides.
I mean, it really is the second half of the story.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
But anyways, you're finishing your story about the picture.
Yeah. It picks up right where they left off. Boom, let's go. And it takes through, and it's been a while, but if you've seen the 1984 movie, it ends at the end of that, which I think is the end of the first of the book Dune. So if you know what happens there, you know, in that story, if you saw the old movie, you know what's happening in this film. But we get to see, and this is, I'm going to take this back to our little image we have of Christopher Walken dancing in the, you remember the old music video Weapon of Choice?
Oh, you're asking me or you're asking the audience?
I'm asking you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I love that video.
Hilarious video. Good stuff. So Christopher Walken plays the Emperor in Dune. So we finally get to see the Emperor and, you know, his daughter and, you know, they come into the picture. But just a few days ago, or no, the day I saw the movie, I was listening to some music. I think it was the day before. And I kid you not, this is completely not deliberate. In my playlist was Weapon of Choice. And I'm bopping my head along to the sound. Do you know the words of that song, Daddy War Pig?
Yes, I do. I use
the word song loosely. So I'm bopping around listening to the song, and the what was the name of the guy he did that with? Bootsy, I think. He's saying, he starts chanting, "Walk without rhythm, and you won't attract the worm." And I sat straight up in my chair, ramrod straight. Holy cow. Weapon of Choice quotes Dune and predicts the future, setting Christopher Walken on, you know, in a path.
On a karmic path.
Karmic path to play the Emperor in Dune 2. I couldn't believe it. Why is Fatboy Slim quoting Dune in this weird song? What does that have to do with anything? I guess it just sounds cool.
Yeah.
I thought that was really funny.
Yeah. One of my favorite songs.
Good stuff. Man, we should digress again. 90s electronic music was outstanding.
Yeah.
I miss it. I pump that stuff up. Whatever they were drinking or taking over in the UK at that time, they came out with a lot of good stuff.
Was it the Isle of Vegas? Is phenomenal by Crystal Method.
Yep, that was 97, I think.
Just killer.
Oh, and I think Crystal Method, I think those are Americans.
Oh, they may be. I don't know.
And it was one of the best. We also had acts like the Chemical Brothers and Orbital and The Prodigy. And these are just the popular ones. These are just the ones that sort of everybody got exposed to around that time. Anyway.
I almost said this on Twitter the other day, but I couldn't make it. I couldn't come up with a way to say it without making it sound pompous. Because it does sound like unbearably hippie-ish, hipster-ish and pompous. But I'm like, I don't usually pay attention to the people behind music. I guess, like, listen to the songs. So
that's normal.
You could have told me they were like Hungarian or Bangladeshi, and for all I know, I'd have been like, oh, okay. So, but yeah. Who else? Who did Burning Wheel?
I don't know that one. Digression over. So yeah, okay. Christopher Walken's in it. They go back to the same moment in time, as you said. Denis Villeneuve wrote and directed it, or had a hand in the screenplay. He directed it, so you're going to get the same, you know, beautiful sweeping vistas of a sci-fi planet. You know, with the haunting musical score and everything. Everything, it's just more of what you got last time. So that was my first impression of it. And like I said, it follows that story to the end. I think the same thing as the 1984 movie. I think that's the end of the first book. And we both really enjoyed it. And I could probably say some more, but what did you think?
I did really enjoy the movie. I had some negative reactions right up front that I had to put aside to enjoy the movie. Florence Pugh may be a lovely person, but she is absolutely just not up to being Irulan. Because Irulan is supposed to be, you know, like literally one of the most beautiful women in the entire galaxy. And Florence Pugh is just not up to that. She just doesn't qualify. A young Virginia Madsen could pull it off in the 1984 Dune.
Yes.
And you just needed...
Dear Lord, yes.
You just needed someone like absolutely gorgeous to play that role, and feminine. And Florence Pugh, she has less of a feminine air about her than Irulan needs. I'm not trying to insult her, and I'm not saying she's ugly, because she isn't ugly, but she doesn't work for that character.
Yeah, I believe I believe we ordered a space empress, and we got we didn't get that.
And then, you know, Timothée Chalamet is really, really pretty, and I don't think Paul is supposed to be really pretty. Someone described him the other day as the best looking boy in seventh grade, and that's why girls love him.
Yeah, I mean, let's go at it. Let's go at it. Like, let's go at the cast, because I think this was one of the weaker aspects of part one, and it's, you know, the cast is the same, so it's still a weak aspect of it. I agree with Timothée Chalamet. What I'll say is, though, that you're absolutely spot on, you know, the way he, you know, with his looks and everything and sort of lack of presence. He's called upon to sort of become Paul Muad'Dib throughout the film. And I think he's greatly improved. I think that he, when especially when he becomes leader of the Fremen, he really fills, you know, he fills the screen, he fills the costume, he fills that role. And that's sort of, I think that's a testament to his ability to act. He's larger. He seems larger on screen than he, you know, he probably is, right? Especially when you see him in those early scenes and in part one, where you're like, I don't see this scrawny little rat as Paul Atreides. This isn't working for me.
He's had a couple years to grow older, and that's helped him. And he really is a talented actor. I'm not going to take that away from him.
Yeah.
I can't say he's a bad actor. He's not a bad actor. And this movie proves it. I mean, if you've seen him in Dune or seen him in Wonka and say, oh, he's just a bad actor, he's not a bad actor, because he really did carry that role off. And they didn't do all the typical things that you know what they do when they've got really good-looking actors who are supposed to play butch men. They grow them, like, unshaven beard, like a big noticeable unshaven beard and stuff. They didn't do all those tricks. He still has the same, you know, curly, longer hair. He gets a little tanned, but you'd expect that being in this, you know, super desert planet. But he really does in those, once he goes through the trials to become a warrior of the Fremen, the way he carries himself, the way he uses his voice, the way he does it, he really fills that role. And you can kind of, you can see, okay, he undergoes this change from this skinny, you know, kind of mama's boy into something that you could see people respecting.
Mm-hmm. And he had to deliver that. That's part of the story, right? He had to, because of course his mother, as the Bene Gesserit, is attempting to direct events in, you know, her favor or their favor, and so he's got to stand up to her and, you know, take control of everything and sort of become that man, that leader of the Fremen. He does the job.
Yeah.
You already mentioned Florence Pugh. Yeah. Enough said about her. Shani, what?
Really don't want to, like, seem like I'm attacking her personally, because she's not a bad actor. She's a
no. Let's move on. We've already talked about Florence Pugh. What about we talked about Mom, Rebecca Ferguson as Jessica. Sort of a thankless job. She does fine. It's fun to be the bad guy, or is she good or bad? I don't know.
She is pushed by her role as his mom into doing things that she maybe doesn't want to do, but she still does. And that's, yeah. You know, I mean, that's kind of the ultimate thing about being a woman is Rudyard Kipling has that poem, "The female of a species is more deadly than the male." That's a kind of her role in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Is she's a mother. She's literally trying to defend her son. And then her daughter, her unborn daughter. And so, yeah, she comes out as a mother who's willing to do anything to defend what's left of her family. So I wouldn't call her a bad guy as much as she is really just desperate and trying to hold a dangerous situation together and going in the one direction she can see them going in to survive, to get out of this situation that others have put her in. It's not like she sought this out. You know, she's not doing this because Duke Leto came to Arrakis and this is part of the scheme to get power to, you know, pump spice. This is entirely a situation of the Emperor and Baron Harkonnen's making. So she's just making the best of this very bad situation she got put into. So I don't think she's a bad guy. I think she's ruthless, but that's what you kind of expect of a mother at this point. And I think Rebecca Ferguson carries that role off well.
Very good. Very good. Some of the other, let's see, other strengths of the cast, you know, Stellan Skarsgård's back is Baron Harkonnen. Awesome.
Yeah.
Bautista is a, go ahead. You want to say something about that?
No. I was going to say something, but I have to look up something on IMDb while you're talking. So I'm going to let you talk.
Yeah. Like strengths of the cast, Stellan Skarsgård, Baron Harkonnen, all the Harkonnens, right? Sure, David Bautista is just being Bautista, doing his thing. But that's a perfect character for him. Sort of the, you know, the dumb Brutus, broody guy. We've got Austin Butler. I don't remember seeing him in anything before.
Okay.
Austin Butler as Fade. He's no Sting, but the way he acts and the makeup they did on them, everything having to do with the Harkonnens, I thought was great. They just look and feel and sound so menacing.
So
they come right up to the point of being cliche or hokey or cheesy villains, but it's fun to watch.
Austin Butler, the very first time I saw him was in the MTV TV series Shannara, which was terrible. And I reviewed that for this show many years ago. And Austin Butler, just in and of himself, is a really good looking guy. He's not as pretty as Timothy Chalamet, but he's just really good looking. And so you kind of discount him as an actor because he's so good looking. And then he went off and did a bunch of, you know, smaller roles and things. He was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He was in The Dead Don't Die, you know, and he's had a few TV shows, movie appearances, nothing big. I mean, like a very few. So then he was in Elvis, and he plays Elvis, which I haven't seen, but I've heard a lot of people say was really good. And then he is in Masters of the Air, which I've been talking about, right? Which has its last episode on Friday, so I'm going to give that a review next week. And he plays one of the main characters in that, and he does an absolutely phenomenal job playing his character. So between this movie and between Masters of the Air, I don't know if it's just because he's matured since 2016, 2017. Man, that's 7 years ago. That's a lot of age and experience under his belt. I don't know if he's just matured or it's just because he aged or what it was, but he's turned into a really good actor. And so I kind of had to, I didn't even remember why I thought of him as this lightweight, why I rolled my eyes when they said he was in Dune. I couldn't even remember why, except I saw him and I'm like, oh, that guy. I didn't remember that until I saw, I was flipping through my iTunes stuff the other night and I saw Shannara Chronicles and I'm like, oh, that's where I remember him from. But he did a great job with his character in this movie. He didn't have a lot to work with. And even though his character is a little bit one note, he really inhabited the character and brought it to life.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the problem with the, I don't know if that's Fade in the book, but he's clearly just a one note character. Like he's just a psychopath. He showed up, he understood the assignment, and he was a menacing psychopath. What more do you want?
Yeah. I mean, he put enough vitality and life into the role that you could buy him as a human being and not a cliche. So, I mean, there really are actually psychopaths in the real world, and you could buy this. So even without a lot of lines, even without a lot of scenes, you could buy him as a real person without a lot of material to work with. And that's a talented actor when you can get that far. So, yeah. Apparently, Elvis is good, so I may watch that just to see how good he did in Elvis. But between Masters of the Air and this movie, Austin Butler has managed to make me completely forget about his role in Shannara, or the Shannara Chronicles, or whatever the hell it was.
Well, good.
And then we had some surprises show up for, so the next book after this is Children of Dune. And Denis Villeneuve, after making this movie, is going to go off and make some other movie, and then he's going to make Children of Dune. So some of the things that don't make sense in this movie will make sense in Children of Dune. So they had, and this is a tiny little bit of a spoiler, they had an actress playing Aaliyah, who is his unborn sister, who gets dosed with the, you know, psionically active drug called the Water of Life, who appears to him in an adult form. And the reason why that occurs is to set up Children of Dune. So that scene completely wastes a big name actress, or at least a moderately big name actress nowadays. And you're like, why the hell did that happen? What does that have to do with anything? And what it has to do with anything is it's setting up the third movie. Now I'm betting the studio will go on and make like Dune Messiah and God Improved Dune and who knows past that. But Denis Villeneuve said he's not doing those, but he is doing Children of Dune. And then they have Leah Seydoux show up with the funniest line in the entire movie. And I don't know how to describe this. It's a plot point directly from the novel. She says, Leah Seydoux is sent in to seduce Fade Rotha. And she says he was sexually vulnerable to seduction by Leah Seydoux.
Mm-hmm.
Because only Fade Rotha is sexually vulnerable to seduction by Leah Sidhu. Because that's an unusual state of mind. I mean, it's not like every other man in the entire rest of the galaxy wouldn't be vulnerable to seduction by Leah Sidhu. No, no, no. You have to note that specially for Fade Rotha, because that's unusual.
Right.
But anyway, she's looking, of course, gorgeous, as you would expect if you've seen her in the James Bond movies. It's just a hilarious line. You're like, really? Really? I mean, if that were like Amy, what's her name? I could see that. But no, Leah Sidhu, you didn't need to be a real expert at seduction to draw him in. So yeah, it's I think that just about everybody else does a really good job with what they're done. I don't think Zendaya has enough gravitas to pull off the part she's given, but she tries really hard.
What do they say? Bless her heart.
Bless her
heart. Absolute. This insistence on forcing these actors on us. You know, we remarked Timothy Chalamet is a good actor, but doesn't seem to fit the part. Florence Pugh is just not space empress, whether she's a good actress or not. Anya Taylor-Joy, I don't know why they keep casting her in movies. I don't think she's a great actress. And Zendaya, it feels like that. What was that inclusivity or diversity code that we're... I mean, she's a model or a former model. I get it. But yeah, she also doesn't have the beauty or the acting chops to pull off what is like the most important supporting character in the film. You know, Dune Part One made it clear that Chani was going to play a much bigger role in the story than perhaps she does in the original story. And you know, I mean, but people have been saying this ever since Spider-Man. She can't even pull off Mary Jane. So what are you going to do? I hate to say that, right? Because I've got nothing against her personally. It's just, you know, when you cast a movie, you set certain expectations. She does not meet them. It's too bad. I'll give her this, though. It's like you said. She really puts an effort in. And she tries really hard. And of course, she's got these moments at the end, you know, where she has to actually show some serious emotion. And she does. Does it look a little bit less like, you know, a hardened desert warrior and a little bit more like a pouting child? Maybe. Maybe I'm being totally unfair. No. Because that's what it looked like to me. And it didn't really harm the experience for me. It's not like it was a surprise that it was going to happen. It was just like, yeah. Still, I really enjoyed the movie. Like, the weaknesses are there. You just go to the cast listing and you can see all the weaknesses there. And you're like, that's weird that they cast it like that. But I really enjoyed it all the way through.
Yeah, I did. It was definitely an enjoyable movie. I was a little disappointed at the end because they went just a little bit past the end of the first book, and that's the setup, Children of Dune. Instead of letting Paul be victorious over the Emperor and that being the end of the movie, which is the end of the book, they go into, oh, the houses have all rejected him and the holy wars begin, has begun. That leads up to Children of Dune. So,
and it, that was, you know, that's a deliberate choice that has its pros and cons, right? Because,
yeah,
you know, having that set up, you know, gets you geared up for the next episode or the next movie. But this isn't a TV show. Maybe it would have been better to just end with that nice, you know, catharsis, you know, after 2-3 hour movies.
Oh.
Paul, you know, has avenged his father and claimed his birthright and then some.
Yeah. And see, that's the thing. This is the one big weakness of this movie. You really do need to have seen the first movie sometime in the previous year to be ready to watch this movie. Because they really are two halves of a longer movie. And if you haven't seen it in the last year, you're not going to get all of it. Like, Spice plays a really big role in the first movie. They have lots of shots of it, and you see it, and it establishes how omnipresent it is on Arrakis, whereas Spice barely makes an appearance visually in this movie. They talk about it, and occasionally you see little hints of it, but even when they have like a Spice patch where they're trying to harvest it, you don't really see much of the, you know, glittering cinnamony images of it. So to get that feeling of how omnipresent Spice is on Arrakis, you have to have seen the first movie so that impression carries with you through the second movie. And there are a lot of little things like that that just, the second movie is better if you've seen the first movie close to it, because it's a whole story. It's just two halves of the same story. And I'm not saying that's good, or I'm not saying that's a knock on this movie. I'm not saying that lowers the quality of this movie. I'm just saying it is what it is.
I mean, it clearly reduces its value as a movie, but if you are familiar with the story, or if you've at least seen the first part and barely kept up, if you're at least that familiar with the film, then you can enjoy it. And if you're not, we're running low on time, so let's talk about the other big thing about it. Is the film enjoyable on the technical merits? Did you enjoy the scenes? You know, much of it green screen or animated or whatever. Did you enjoy the visual aspect of it?
I know all CGI is going to age, and in like 5 years or whatever, it'll probably look bad. Although there are some movies that have avoided that, we'll probably look back and think, oh, well, that doesn't actually look so good. But right now, this movie looks awesome. I thought it looked great. There's a scene where the Harkonnen are jumping up a cliff on jetpacks, and a scene where another character is jumping off a ship on a jetpack, and those both look awesome. The scenes where they were using artillery to blow some stuff up looked great. The sandworms looked really cool, and they had a different interpretation of how they moved when people were riding them than they did in the 1984 movie. And I thought those were fine. I thought those were, you know, really cool interpretations. I thought both of them were valid and both of them were equal. A lot of the things in this movie that were different from the 1984 version, I thought were equally as valid interpretations of it. There were some things that were better in this version than the 1984 version. There were some things that were worse in this version than the 1984 version. But I thought that a lot of it was just different artistic interpretations of it, and that it was really, really enjoyable. I thought that the, obviously, CGI scenes where the big worms are chasing, you know, the soldiers across the ground, and you saw those pictures in the trailer for the big battle scene, that looked incredible. I thought that looked amazing. And they intercut it with real you know, in-camera shots of soldiers on the ground level. So it wasn't just endless CGI after endless CGI. They kept on bringing it back to this individual level with sand on people's faces and them dealing with rocks and dealing with knives and swords and all of that, so that the CGI wasn't the entirety of everything. It was these big events that were playing around these small human moments of brutal hand-to-hand combat. And I thought they did that really, really well. It kind of kept it, you know, grounded. It kept it feeling real despite the CGI. And I think that's where a lot of, and I know they're a favorite movie to knock on, but well, they'll just have to take it. I think there were a lot of Marvel movies, especially the recent ones, have gone wrong. They just don't bother to keep things grounded. It's all just big CGI poof, fighting big CGI poof. Whereas in this movie, the soldiers are physically people who are physically there. And I'm talking in for the close shots. Obviously, when there's big wide shots and there's literally, you know, tens of thousands of soldiers, not, they didn't make tens of thousands of costumes and have people there, but they have these shots of soldiers fighting in this very intense scenes, and they're real people in real uniforms that you can watch being there, and it lends authenticity to the combat that makes you feel like you're watching something real enough to keep you suspending disbelief. And I did like that. I thought they did that well.
Yeah, well said. I'd agree. To your first point about aging shots, I think there were quite a few shots, notably on the worms, where you had sort of a parallax effect where there was, you know, animation of the sand dunes going on behind in the background as characters are moving in the foreground. I thought those shots looked a little cheesy, like something out of an old B movie. They may age poorly, but they might just be charming. I particularly liked the as fake as they were, I liked the wide sweeping shots. You know, every scene felt like it was on a totally different planet. Of course, the completely washed out grayscale on the Harkonnen's world, that was really stunning. And my only complaint really about the sets and the design and stuff like that are those rooms, those big empty rooms that have nothing. I don't know what it is about sci-fi movies where, you know, the most futuristic guest room is literally just, it looks like just black plastic molded into, you know, the shape of a couch or something. I don't think even the people on Living Under the Harkonnens live like that. That didn't feel right. Everything else, it was really beautiful and not distractingly computer generated.
And I, it made the Harkonnens world, the black interiors were really creepy without being like, it's not like they stuck like H.R. Geiger sculptures everywhere. It was just subtly creepy, like inhuman, like it made you wonder why a human, just feel kind of implicitly that like no human would want to live like that, but here these Harkonnens were living like that and forcing other people to live like that. So it just kind of upped their creepiness factor a bunch, in a really subtle way.
Subtle. No, that's, it's obvious that that's where they were going for. I don't think it was subtle at all. It didn't feel realistic. Like they were already creepy enough.
Well, those sets and the guest bedroom stuff creeped me out. It made me feel creepy. So, I mean, I didn't notice I felt creepy, but you know, it did make me feel creepy. So, they succeeded on that level. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah. No, I get you. So, wow, we actually saw a good movie for once. How about that?
We did.
Yeah. Any last thoughts on Dune Part 2?
It's a really enjoyable movie. Be ready when you see it. Channing and Paul's relationship is kind of the axis upon which the first half of the movie sort of rotates. And even when it takes a back seat in the second half, it still is a major theme. And then the other relationships there, Stilgar's relationship with him, his mother's relationship with him, another character who returns from the first movie's relationship with him. I'm not going to spoil it if you don't know. If you've seen the 84 movie or you read the books, you know who I'm talking about, but I'm not going to spoil it for people who haven't. You know, Paul is the fulcrum around which the entire movie rotates. And even though I felt like they took some little things out to be more modern audience-y in a little bit, Paul is still the fulcrum around which everything rotates. And it's his actions and his decisions which drive the movie. He is what makes it happen. And so I saw some people who were either complaining about it, and I have seen complaints about it, or were worrying about it after the first movie, that they were going to make this second movie into the Chani movie, where she was going to become the main character, she was going to be driving the movie, and everything would be about her. And that's absolutely not the case. She is beside Paul, and she helps Paul, but it is still Paul's will, Paul's point of view, Paul's decision that drives what happens. And the crucial moment that changes everything, Paul isn't badgered or convinced by any of the women who are trying to guide him or convince him. And if they were going for, people have accused Chani of being a girl boss character. And the crucial moment where he makes the decision, that is the critical decision in this movie, it is him gathering information and coming to a decision on his own. People have tried to influence him one way or another, but he makes the men and women, he makes the decision on its own. This is not a whipped mother's boy being ordered about by girl bosses. And he's surrounded by, you know, women with powerful wills who have, who are used to getting their way. You know, the Bene Gesserit Reverend Mother from the first movie, his mom, and the other Reverend Mothers and women from the Fremen, Princess Irulan, and so on and so forth. But this is not a movie where the man is whipped around. He's not weak. And that's why you can buy Paul as being this leader. Is he's not a weak leader who allows other people to order him around. He takes command and he takes charge. And he may have seemed really boyish and effeminate in the first movie, but by the end of this movie, he's very strong and masculine, and he's quite a leader. So he's kind of grown up, and it's really refreshing and unexpected to see that. Not just because I didn't expect Denis Villeneuve to go that way, but because I didn't expect that Timothée Chalamet could carry it off, and he does. He carries it off at least enough that you can plausibly watch it and say that. There's enough things here. If you wanted to pick at all of them and magnify those things, or if you just saw it a different way, I could understand why you wouldn't like it. But all of these complaints I've seen about it on Twitter or in other videos I disagree with. And it's inherent in the original story. Just the Bene Gesserit existing means that this is a universe where powerful women with mystical abilities manipulate politics. But the story of this movie is of Paul having been born to be a pawn of powerful women manipulating him for politics, how he takes charge because he is the Kwisatz Haderach, how he takes charge and does things that they can't, even though they've, you know, kept that from the movie. He takes charge and does things that other people can't, that the women can't, and breaks free of their dictates, their political dictates. And, you know, his mother urges him, go south, take up the mantle, become the Lisan al-Gaib, become the Mahdi. And what he decides in the end, whether it goes along or doesn't go along with what the wishes of the people surrounding him are, men and women, are because he chooses to do so based on his own mind and his own insights and what he sees in the world and what he sees in himself and how to protect himself, how to protect his family, and how to protect the future.
There it is, the last word. Well said. I think for my part, first of all, you're absolutely right. And I really enjoyed it. Super great film. I hope everybody who hung out with us goes and checks it out if they haven't already. You'll have a good time. But like we said at the top, go rewatch the first one. Or unless if you're not a big Dune fan, you don't know the story already, go rewatch the first one so you know what's happening. But I'm signing off for this week. Daddy Warpig. Oh, with one program note, tune in later this week on This is Dunder Moose here on YouTube. They're going to have a special guest talking about D&D, Bro Asar, and everything else. Yours truly. We'll be talking D&D for as many hours as we can.
I was going to ask, is it you? But you beat me to it.
It is totally me. That'll be on YouTube. I think it's... Oh, I didn't even prepare the link. My goodness, what am I thinking? YouTube.com. It's This is Dunder Moose on YouTube. And I'm going to post that link in the chat and in the show notes later. Just so that you can see it. But look for that. That's this Wednesday, the 13th.
All right. I want to thank everyone who tuned in live, and I want to thank everyone who will tune in later. This is Geek Gab. We're here just about every Monday night, 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. Feel free to subscribe and click the bell icon so you get a notice as to when we're going live. Don't forget to check out geek-gab.com for our blog. We're putting up a lot of blog posts there that we don't have time to cover on the show. Also, YouTube.com/GeekGab for the live show, or you can catch us on the iTunes show, the Google Play show, the Google iTunes store, the Google Play store, or on SoundCloud.com. Just do a search for Geek Gab, and you will find us to subscribe on the device of your choice or download us to your computer. We have Patreon, we have a subscribe star. Please, just go to GeekGab, patreon.com/GeekGab, subscribestar.com/geek-gab to please donate and support the show. We would appreciate it so very much. We are signing out for today, folks. But don't you worry. Don't you fret. We will be back.